This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
This evening I'm going to try and set out the elements of post Keynesian economics and its main differences from the mainstream.
I thought so.
I'm very conscious that a brief survey like this has inevitable limitations, and I'm relying on John McCombie here to fill in the gaps after I've finished. I'm sure he'll put me right where I stray, especially as this is the first time I've attempted to present such a survey of the whole school of thought, minefields and all. Nevertheless, I think it is reasonable for people to expect a short and clear account of what is post-Keynesian economics, why do we bother with it, and what difference does it make. My approach will be to focus mainly on questions of policy rather than doctrine. Although theoretical clarification remains important, particularly to me and to a long roll call of colleagues from Jeff Harcourt onwards, tonight I want to demonstrate two main things. First, that post-Keynesian thought is already a coherent alternative to the mainstream paradigm, and second, that it is a powerful tool for the analysis of current economic policy. As we shall see, some of the policy implications are sufficiently different to raise understandable doubts as to their likelihood of inclusion in, say, the next UK government's manifesto, that it seems to me that our job as economists must be to follow our reasoning to its practical conclusions. This is particularly important as the conventional opposition to those conclusions itself reflects a theory of the economy which, to quote Keynes, is misleading and disastrous if we attempt to apply it to the facts of experience. So, the distinctive and unifying feature of post-Keynesian economics is the principle of effective demand. Keynes set out his Marshallian version in Chapter 3 of his General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, while Kaletsky independently developed another version on Marxist lines. But the theoretical differences need not detain us. The key implication of the principle of effective demand is that, contrary to what students are now taught, demand matters in the long run as well as in the short. In particular, the level of employment and economic activity, both in the short and in the long run, is determined by demand, by the monetary configuration of our economic system. And this has nothing to do with sticky prices, wages, or other rigidities. Indeed, a virtue of Keynes's Marshallian approach to effective demand is that it scotches on its own terms the mainstream claim that free competition will lead to full employment. By full employment, they mean, of course, the so-called natural rate determined by the supply side. The principle of effective demand leads to a quite different perspective on economic fluctuations. The economy is not like a lifeboat, buffeted by the waves yet always self-righting. The very terms business cycle and stabilisation are loaded, and imaginary trends are easily constructed. The post-Keynesian perspective is that the long run is simply a series of short runs. Certainly the economy fluctuates, but there is no automatic tendency towards equilibrium in level or trend. And that brings us straight to policy. to the current policy of cutting the public sector in order to reduce its crowding out of private activity. That policy follows directly from the concept of an equilibrium rate of output and employment, such that resources released from one occupation flow naturally into others through price competition. It is allowed that market forces may need a little help to smooth the way and overcome the odd imperfection in information and so on. Yet to a post-Keynesian, the idea of cutting 700,000 public sector jobs in order to stimulate private employment, in a situation anywhere short of full and growing employment, appears sheer madness. Notwithstanding yesterday's letter to the Telegraph by captains of industry supporting cuts, entrepreneurs create jobs because they foresee a profitable demand, not because they see a queue of unemployed workers at their door. And the unemployed themselves make poor entrepreneurs. A debate about the balance between public and private sector employment is legitimate, but the argument for cuts has been couched in terms of a crisis in the public finances. The belief that putting public sector workers out of jobs will per se encourage growth of private employment can only be sustained by the self-righting myth, the idea that demand will look after itself. Say's law will prevail. But note, however, that effective demand is not the same as aggregate demand. Supply matters too. And I was interested to read in Stephen Dunn's recent interview of Tony Lawson in the Review of Political Economy that Richard Kahn once walked out on Bob Rothorn for saying just that, that supply matters. But I'm not going to talk about our internal differences. The spending of money is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for full employment. And this is important for several reasons, including the balance of payments. Yet it is a serious defect in mainstream economics to have reduced all long-term questions to matters of the supply side. Lack of demand destroys capacity and technology, and conversely, demand is a key stimulus for innovation and investment in post-Keynesian theory. So that's a first difference. Returning to the short term, another difference is over the theory of interest. This also ties up with the current debate. We are told that the deficit must be reduced because public borrowing crowds out private demand for loanable funds. Well, actually, we've heard rather less about this since the election and more about the confidence of foreign investors, which I'll come back to later. Yet mainstream economics does cling to the idea that the rate of interest, or at least the natural rate of interest, is the price which clears the market for saving and investment. The message is that thrift must be encouraged in order to reduce interest rates and increase private investment. Now, Keynes's most famous insight was, as James Mead put it, that the investment dog wags the savings tail, not the other way round. Investment can never be crowded out by a lack of thrift, of saving, only by a lack of finance or money. The perennial confusion between savings and money owes something, I think, to the fact that most economists have no idea of accounting, despite the best efforts of Basil Moore, Wynne Godley, and Marc Lavoie. The confusion is an elementary error. Any bookkeeper understands that saving and money are on opposite sides of the balance sheet. Do we at present suffer from a lack of finance? Long-term interest rates are at a record low, and were so even before the election, contra the claim that it is only the present government's commitment to drastic spending cuts that has maintained confidence. What about the foreign investors? Well, there is an important difference between sovereign debt issued in the domestic and a foreign currency. We're not in the position of Greece or Ireland. And I will return to the role of international capital markets later on. Deficits on the government's current account are probably not sustainable forever, and Keynes was certainly against them, although some post-Keynesians argue otherwise. I'm thinking here of Randy Ray and the Kansas City School in the land of the world's paper gold. Even if deficits must be closed over time to maintain bondholder confidence, this can be done by increasing tax revenue, partly through a recovery in income, the main thing, partly through increased rates of taxation, partly by new taxes on bads rather than on goods, for example, a carbon tax, and taxes on capital. As Victoria Chick demonstrated last week, if the objective is to reduce the debt burden, i.e. the ratio of debt to income, the lesson of history is that this is only achieved by keeping direct government expenditure growing. The budget cannot be balanced if there are powerful forces leading the private sector to run a surplus and to keep the trade balance in deficit. These forces need to be addressed directly by methods other than cutting government spending or increases in tax. The attempt to balance the budget by austerity will succeed, if it does, only by impoverishing us in the process. Nevertheless, if spending on current account is deemed politically unsustainable because of the long-term tax implications, let the total spending be maintained on capital account until the economy recovers, allowing the government itself to create employment by private sector contractors as it reduces its direct employment. Would we burden the next generation by providing them with more or better housing, schools, hospitals, energy and transport systems? Are the cutters really claiming that investment in a healthier, better educated and housed population and greener, more efficient infrastructure will not pay off in higher national income over, say, 50 years? And if such investments do require financial underwriting against a possible failure to capture their benefits in tax revenue, is there not a strong case for a long-term capital levy or wealth tax to reduce the debt balance, since the blame for this recession lies squarely with the financial sector? So I look forward to hearing Malcolm Sawyer's verdict on the spending review, which we look forward to tomorrow, when he speaks to this seminar on the 30th of November. So far, I've introduced the post-Keynesian principle of effective demand and the consequent repudiation of the loanable funds theory of interest against the idea that there are natural rates of output, employment and interest, an idea which underpins the claim that the public sector crowds out private employment in any short-term sense. A further implication of the principle of effective demand is that aggregate employment and real wages are determined in the product market and not the so-called labour market. Money wages determine only the relative real wages of different employees, not the aggregate real wage of labour as a whole. The real wage, the aggregate real wage, is simply the resultant of money wages and product prices, and it is not, as in mainstream economics, an independent causal force in the form of a price that clears a competitive market for labour. The mainstream idea that labour and other factor markets are just like product markets leaves no room for long-term demand-deficient unemployment. As a matter of scientific integrity, so Keynes generously puts it, observed unemployment, in this account, must be voluntary due to wage stickiness or fecklessness, or the result of frictions related to information, retraining, or geography. The doctrine of flexible labour markets follows. Unemployment is due to a lack of competition and restrictive practices on the part of labour, or, of course, the infamous tax on jobs that we heard about before the election. There is, of course, much to be said for policies that make it easier for workers to retrain and move voluntarily from one job to another as the pattern of demand changes. Equally, it is important that employment and welfare policies do not create perverse incentives, preventing a rational reallocation of labour in the long-term interests of both workers and the economy as a whole. However, the flexible labour market is often simply a euphemism for an attack on organised labour, employment, employment protection rights, and welfare benefits. We do not cure unemployment by bullying the workers. Another implication of the principle of effective demand is that the money wage determines not employment, but the price level. There's no room in post-Keynesian theory for the quantity theory of money. Equally, there's no room for the idea that class struggle can change the aggregate share of wages in national income. Of course, an individual union can improve its relative position at the expense of other workers, but a rise in money wages across the board simply produces inflation. The real wage and profit shares are determined by a combination of the degree of competition between employers and the rate of interest. The post-Keynesian remedy for inflation has always been some form of incomes policy combined with commodity price stabilisation. The failure of incomes policy in the 1970s may partly have reflected the belief of some union leaders that labour as a whole could increase its real wage by industrial action, which I have said is a mistake from a post-Keynesian perspective. More generally, union action then reflected the need to defend relative money wages, which certainly are real for the workers in question, and an overall failure to recognise that real wages had to fall, at least temporarily, because of the commodity price increases at the time. From this perspective, inflation targeting is a clever exercise in political psychology. I hesitate to say a confidence trick. Philip Orestes and Malcolm Sawyer have shown that the variation of interest rates cannot explain that of inflation under this regime. Yet if enough people believe that the Bank of England can control inflation, or that inflation expectations are anchored by the monthly inspection of the entrails, or even if there is simply a tacit agreement among wage setters to use the inflation target as the negotiating benchmark, it seems that so far that we avoid the outbreak of fratricidal rivalry between workers. This seems to have held even when productivity dictates that real wages must stagnate or fall. Unions have also learned the hard way that the mayhem of the 1970s did not serve them well. The Scandinavians seem to have managed this far better than us in the UK, and I look forward to hearing more about that from Jesperson and Jonathan Perriton at the seminar on the 23rd of November. Perhaps the most significant thing the new Labour leader could achieve in opposition is the forging of a new consensus on incomes policy among the union movement in preparation for a return to a government commitment to full employment. Also, it'll be very interesting to hear what Charles Goodhart, Illuminatus Emeritus of the Monetary Policy Committee, has to say about all this next week on the 26th of October. So while the principle of effective demand is the key theoretical concept in post-Keynesian economics, its importance arises from the physical character of a monetary economy, and in particular the nature of durable capital assets, including money, as a bridge between the present and the future. Post-Keynesian economics takes time seriously. Production takes time. Time to make, as well as to use, the tools of an advanced technology under a specialized division of labor. The flow of time is irreversible, and the future is unknowable. The value of capital assets depends on future events, which are subject to uncertainty, not merely to statistical random variation or risk. As Paul Davidson puts it, the world is non-ergodic, a term of which John Hicks said, "You need a word like that to ram a point home." The value of money is as an indefinite claim on future production, which does not commit the holder to a decision. We call this liquidity. It is therefore a mistake, as Tony Lawson, Sheila Dow, and indeed Jesper Jespersen rightly insist, to apply the well-tried statistical methods of the physical sciences to the subject matter of macroeconomics. We cannot close the system, undertake controlled experiments, or make reliable predictions of economic variables. That is not to say that we cannot offer insight and explanation, identify causal mechanisms, and therefore predict, in a non-temporal sense, the likely consequences of specific policies. But we have more in common with historians than physicists. The financial crisis has brought this home once again. The efficient markets hypothesis holds that asset prices are reliable indicators of fundamental value, allowing for the statistical variation which can be overcome by portfolio spread. The failure to recognize systemic risk, in the sense that both the stock market and the banking system can crash, can be traced at root to this comfortable but exceedingly dangerous hypothesis, the efficient markets hypothesis. The post-Keynesian view is that there is no such thing as fundamental value, except with hindsight. Asset valuations are necessarily a matter of convention and are subject to discontinuous shifts in market sentiment. Liquidity has value only because the future is unknowable. The value of liquidity increases with our fear of our own ignorance. And these considerations taken together lead to a post-Keynesian perspective on the financial sector very different from the mainstreams. First of all, post-Keynesians follow Kaletsky, Galbraith, and Eichner in recognizing the well-established empirical evidence about the financing of investment. This is that the vast majority of physical capital formation or accumulation is financed from the internal cash flow of large corporations, supplemented to some extent by bank credit lines. The social purpose of the stock market is not to finance new physical investment, but to permit transfers of existing assets, including corporate control. Its speculative tendencies are not, in fact, offset by the benefits for enterprise which Keynes himself allowed. industry could function quite well without the equity market. Given alternative institutions focused on enterprise rather than speculation. Secondly, following Minsky and the detailed analysis by Victoria Chick of the evolution of the banking system, there seems to be a pathological tendency in our society to misuse debt. This is driven partly by the speculative opportunities provided by the equity market, but also by those of the housing market in certain countries such as the UK and US. The efficient markets hypothesis has combined with the idea of intertemporal consumption smoothing to provoke a free-for-all in credit markets. Banks have reverted to their ancient role as irresponsible money lenders rather than respectable financiers of enterprise and James Stewart-style providers of personal finance. The foolish idea that governments could tame the wild beasts of Wall Street rather than keeping them in secure cages, together with a well-intentioned but misguided notion of deposit insurance, has led to the taxpayer picking up the bill for the party. Post-Keynesians would, in the words of Winston Churchill, see finance less proud and industry more content. Keynes thought casino banking should be kept expensive and inaccessible. A significant transactions tax going well beyond the current stamp duty should be imposed, a tax on speculation. Secondly, as Ajit Singh demonstrated long time ago, there is no evidence that takeovers promote efficiency. Corporate governance should be reformed in the direction of greater accountability to stakeholders other than shareholders, notably but not exclusively workers. Then takeovers might be based on their true industrial merits, not the manipulations of corporate raiders. Thirdly, the license to take retail deposits, with its implicit state guarantee, and to manage the payment system, should be restricted to publicly owned institutions or at least to utility banks, restricted to investing in particular classes of asset. Private pension provision also carries a state guarantee, in the sense that those who suffer investment losses are ultimately underwritten. We therefore need a decent state pension backed by securities issued by government and by dedicated development banks funding long-term infrastructure with secure returns and again with effective, democratic, accountable corporate governance. By all means, let people make risk investments in other things for higher returns, if they wish, but caveat emptor. There's no sign that governments have learned very much from the 2008 crisis, and the current proposals for the reform of banking regulation are hopelessly timid. The City and Wall Street appear to be just too well organised and politically powerful. And it will be interesting to hear what Sheila Dow has to say about this when she talks about financial regulation on the 9th of November. Another plaything of the markets in recent years has been the exchange rate. Post-Keynesians dispute the claim that there is a natural tendency to equilibrium in the balance of payments, driven by fundamentals and brought about by a market clearing exchange rate. You can listen to a full talk by John Harvey about this on the website. Tony Thirlwall and John McCombie have done the work in developing the theory of balance of payments constrained growth. The problem is that just as domestic savers can hoard money rather than invest, so can whole currency areas. Critically, there is no penalty for accumulating reserves, only for running out of them. The result is a deflationary bias to the global economy, offset only by the happy accident, in one sense, that the US can use its exorbitant privilege to print paper gold to finance its payments deficits. Meanwhile, by its Faustian pact with the capital markets, the UK has for the time being solved the financing of its trade deficit by becoming a hub for capital flows orders of magnitude greater than the trade balance. Post-Keynesian economists argue that exchange rates should be consciously managed, like money wage rates, by a system of fixed but adjustable pegs intended to maintain relative purchasing power parity. This cannot be done in a world of unlimited capital mobility. Long-term capital flows by way of foreign direct investment and so on are mainly desirable, but short-term portfolio flows have to be subordinated to the interests of exchange rate stability and the growth of trade, employment, and productivity. The Bretton Woods system, for all its flaws, saw the highest rates of growth of trade and output in history. Yet such a system cannot be sustained in a world where payments surplus countries refuse to accept revaluation as inflation rates diverge, nor can the international reserve currency be the property of a single nation. These two flaws, the lack of an onus on surplus countries to adjust their exchange rates and invest their surpluses, and the ultimate lack of credibility of the US promise of gold convertibility, were at the heart of the failure of Bretton Woods. The logical policy conclusion of post-Keynesian analysis was identified by Kaldor and Tinbergen in 1964. As an international commodity reserve currency, backed by stocks of the 30 or so key commodities in world trade. Unlike the gold standard or the euro, domestic currencies would remain on a peg that could be adjusted if their domestic inflation diverged from the global. Such a system would do much to anchor commodity prices and reduce the risk of imported inflation, as well as stabilise the incomes of commodity-dependent developing countries. It would incur storage costs, but these would hardly be greater than the costs of a financial sector grossly swollen by the activities of international portfolio investment and currency trading. Seen through post-Keynesian eyes, the churning of existing assets, however profitable, does not add to social welfare. A reformed international monetary system with full employment as its objective would allow payments-constrained countries to achieve their potential and provide commodity-dependent countries with the resources to diversify. Kaldor coined the term Verdun's Law for the relationship between the growth of output and productivity in manufacturing. In a nutshell, a growing industrial sector provides the incentives for innovation and for the transfer of productive resources from underemployment. Growth is demand-driven. Yes, of course, growth also depends on good governance and institutions, but these are necessary and not sufficient. So, there are several aspects of post-Keynesian economics I have not covered, despite trying your patience. This talk has clearly been about macroeconomic policy, and there are several areas of microeconomics in which post-Keynesians have contributed, including Marc Lavoie on consumption, Paul Downward and Fred Lee on industrial pricing, as well as Adrian Winnett and Eric Baer on the environment, who came to speak last term. And I'm hoping that John will fill in my most glaring gaps. In conclusion, I suggest that the overarching policy thrust of post-Keynesian economics is to regard our economic troubles as a symptom of bad system design or no system design. The mainstream still attempts to apply to a monetary economy the prescriptions of a theory which might have made sense in an economy of yeomen and artisans. By contrast, post-Keynesians identify the dysfunction of our legal and monetary institutions as central. This is both radical, as I'm sure you have recognised, and hopeful. Radical because we cannot expect progress without overcoming serious political and ideological obstacles to the reform of the ownership of corporate property and the relations between states. But hopeful because there is a rational way out of this mess if we can but muster the will. It will be clear that post-Keynesian economics has always been against financial liberalisation, and yes, we did tell you so. We find ourselves as a society still in the grip of a laissez-faire ideology as firm as the Soviet Union's in its time, and this applies to the majority of academic economists also. It's not clear that any democratic political party can shift this consensus outside time of war or other catastrophe. The reform of the international monetary system and the taming of finance requires multilateral cooperation between states and the acceptance that a stable system of exchange rates is a public good. As in the case of climate change and nuclear disarmament, such a reform is against the short-term interests of the United States and demands an almost unprecedented degree of international cooperation. It would be naive to think that progress in science or politics can ever be completely independent of vested interests. Yet Keynes was hopeful that in the long term sound ideas would win through. The stakes are higher now than ever. The recent G20 summit was a lost opportunity. But if the time ever does come again, as in 1945, when governments seek to develop global institutions that govern the economy in the interests of free citizens rather than property, the analytical tools can be found here.
Thank you very much, Mark, for this well-prepared and wide-ranging presentation of the post-Keynesian difference. Well, I fully understood. So that was very interesting to listen to. You focused more on policy than on, as you said, than on doctrines. Perhaps we might come back on doctrines later this afternoon or at another time, but a lot of food for thought, I think, and I pass the word to our colleague and discussant for this afternoon, John McCombie, from Downing College, I should say. Please.
Thank you very much, Jesper. I'm naturally delighted to act as a discussant on Mark's excellent paper, and I think what's encouraging in his talk is that he unequivocally demonstrates the importance of post-Keynesian economics for policy purposes, and indeed the need to keep reiterating the drastic policy mistakes that the current government's been making, even if it is like battering your head against a proverbial brick wall. I suppose, to misquote Mandy Rife Davis, well, I would say this, wouldn't I? And I thought that quote rather dates me, so I said, I'll explain it. It's a perfumer affair, and then I thought that dates me even more, so could you just please ignore it if you don't understand it? Marx's aim was to demonstrate that post-Keynesian thought is already a coherent alternative to the mainstream paradigm, and I think I would not disagree with that at all, and it's a powerful tool for the analysis of macroeconomic policy. The problem I have is that I am, in spite of that, and in spite of agreeing with that, I'm always pessimistic about the future of post-Keynesian economics in academia, and I might say a little bit about that later. I think moving, as Jesper said, away from policy to doctrine, One of the interesting questions, and I think this is why the talk is very apposite, is has the subprime crisis changed the whole academia in macroeconomics by showing up the deficiencies of what generally is now called the new neoclassical synthesis, a term that was coined by Goodfriend, or alternatively it's sometimes called the new consensus in macroeconomics. And I think what's interesting is that when you read the debates, they are not in the academic journals clouded by mathematics and assumptions, etc. They're really going down to the very basics of it. And I'm thinking about the debate between Krugman, Cochrane, Farmer, Brad DeLong. Just read Brad DeLong's website and you'll see what I mean. And stripped of all this, the disagreements are really very fundamental. And I'm struck by a quote Solow made in the 1980s, where he said, well, of course, you know, disagreements always occur at the frontiers of science, but what other faculties find extraordinary is that in economics it's about the fundamentals from the ground upwards. And he comments, other people in his university wonder what sort of subject economics is that you can have that. One of the nice things about Mark's paper was that I was writing a paper about whatever happened to Cantabrian economics, which was a deliberate echo of Jeff's famous paper in Journal of Economic Perspectives. And my rather pessimistic conclusion was that this was the work of Nicky Cowler, Joan Robinson, Pierre Straffer, etc. While they didn't establish a successful paradigm, they did contribute to the development of post-Keynesian economics. And a referee said, please elaborate what you mean by post-Keynesian economics. And I thought, well, that's another paper. Now all I have to do is reference Marx's talk. And that saved me a lot of space. The problem is I'm in a difficult position because it's, as I said, it's easier to be a discussant when you disagree with a paper than it's when you don't. And I could just say here, yes, 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 thank you, Mark. And the other thing is I've got to ensure that I don't descend into hagiography, which is always a temptation. So what I thought I'd like to do, since Mark said I had 25 minutes, is just to have a slight divergence before I actually return to the core of Mark's paper. Perhaps just discuss why I'm still a bit pessimistic about the future of post-Keynesian economics. And to discuss whether or not the subprime crisis has shown the bankrupt nature of the new neoclassical synthesis. Is this a chance for post-Keynesian analysis? Are there other approaches that post-Keynesians should embrace? We've got the new thinking in economics, which was held in King's a few weeks ago. We've got Akerlof's identity economics. We've got behavioural economics. We've got neuroeconomics. Is there anything from these non-mainstream branches of economics that we can learn from? The other thing perhaps I'd like to look at is the ascendancy of the new neoclassical synthesis. How did it arise? Which I sometimes find quite extraordinary. So I said I've been a little bit pessimistic about the future of post-Keynesian economics. This is notwithstanding, again, the flourishing post-Keynesian study group, the excellent newsletter that was founded by Fred Lee, the conference, etc. It's more to do with the grip of the current neoclassical paradigm on academia. And that's in terms of the way the mainstream economist dominates appointments, dominates promotions, ranks journals, which are absolutely crucial for the REE, and the implications this has for the development of post-Keynesian schools. And if we think about it, it's quite difficult to find any physical post-Keynesian schools. If you have a school of thought, it can be, of course, an abstract school, but of course you need communication. Now it's not so difficult with the internet, but when you think of departments that one could say are heterodox, you could probably count them on two hands, which I find very depressing. And it's not because of the doctrinal successes of post-Keynesian economics. I mean, a long time ago, Nicky Cowler said to Paul Davison after the outcome of the capital theory controversy, now surely neoclassical economics must give up marginal productivity theory of factor pricing. And Davison made some comments to the extent that no way. And I think that is ubiquitously been shown. And so the problem seems to be a little bit, although we have very coherent expressions of what post-Keynesian economics are, it's we don't quite have it at the textbook level to use, shall we say, in conjunction with the ubiquitous Mankiw. I mean, there are a lot around. You could Paul Davidson's early classic work, Mark Lavoie, Jesper Jespersen's, other books that certainly would use. But at the moment, first year economics seems to be dominated by Mankiw, which is not, well, I'll maybe just return to that in a moment. We did have the brilliant failure of Eat Well and Robinson. That was written in 1973. It was an alternative textbook. It was very heavily pushed by the publishers. But unfortunately, it really came to naught. There's a very interesting paper by John King and Milmau that actually look at the reasons for the failure of that. So in the meantime, we sort of had the ascendancy of the new classical synthesis, which, if you read some of the journal articles as recently as 2007, as Solo said, they were very self-congratulatory. The Worldwide Progress in Monetary Policy, this is from Good Friend. Worldwide progress in monetary policy is a great achievement, especially when viewed from the perspective of 30 years ago. Today, academics, central bank economists, and policymakers around the world are working together on monetary policy as never before. The worldwide working consensus provides a foundation for the future because it was forged out of the hard practical lessons from diverse national experiences over the decades, and because it provides a common ground upon which academics and central banks can work to improve monetary policy in the future. 2007. You can find similar sentiments in other surveys. Clearly, what has happened is the subprime crisis has led to a major reassessment of macroeconomics. But I think there's a sort of curious schizophrenia in mainstream macroeconomics. At the undergraduate level, if you look at Mankiw, we still teach Keynesian ISLM model. We still teach the aggregate demand, aggregate supply model. We still teach the Mundell-Fleming model. These are, if you like, Keynesian models. They're not post-Keynesian models, because Sir John Hicks says, and if you look at the core of Keynesian general theory, the whole role of uncertainty is gone. And as Hicks himself took a bit of blame for this with the development of the ISLM model. But when you go to the graduate level, all those have gone. What you're back to is the new neoclassical consensus. You're back to rational expectations, real business cycles, the representative agent, so you've got no coordination failures, the absence of any banking sector, no consideration of money, as Marx emphasized, lack of liquidity, and lack of any discussion of uncertainty. So what we have in the consensus is really new classical economics with neo-Keynesian menu costs added on, and that's where the so-called consensus comes from. But the subprime crisis seems to have changed all that. I mean, there are a lot of quotes, and they're being quoted by a number of post-Keynesians in several journal articles. The most famous ones, I think, are from Danny Blanchflower, who was a former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, someone actually engaged in monetary policy, who said, "As a monetary maker, I have found the cutting edge of current macroeconomic research totally inadequate in helping to resolve the problems we currently face. I am far from these views, far from alone from these views." And we certainly got acrimony in the debates that reflect the acrimony that occurred in over-rational expectations like 1970s. Again, just look at the type of debate that is going on, as I said, between Krugman, Krockman, Farmer, DeLong, etc. Also, Boiter, former professor of macroeconomics here at Cambridge and a founding member of the Monetary Policy Committee, talks about typical graduate macroeconomics and monetary economics training received at Anglo-American universities during the past 30 years or so may have set back by decades serious investigations of aggregate economic behaviour and economic policy relevant understanding. It was privately and socially a costly waste of time and other resources. So is this the opening for post-Keynesian economics? And when we look at the subprime crisis, one of the things that is surprising was that it was generally unanticipated. And there's a very nice paper by Bessemer, who cites Robert Rubin, the former US Treasury Secretary, saying few, if any, people anticipated the sort of meltdown that we are seeing in the credit markets at present. Now, there are exceptions to that, and he identifies 10. And what is interesting, one of them, of course, was Wynne Godley. And when he identified these 10, he only included those who made their predictions on the basis of an economic model. And what is interesting is that what is common to many of the group was they used the flow of funds models, which stands in sharp contrast to the neoclassical base generally equilibrium models used by central banks. And this, I think, goes back to Marx's point about accounting identities. The flow of funds model, which one could say is an accounting model or a post-Keynesian model, are based on a consistent matrix of household, governments, and firms' balance sheets. I think the most comprehensive statement is the book by Godley and Lavoie that was published a couple of years ago. And in it, the key features include a circular flow of goods and money, separate representation of stocks, inventories, wealth and debt, and flows, goods, services and funds, explicit modelling of the financial sector as distinct from the real economy and as distinct from dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models. So you got an independent growth and contraction effects from finance on the economy, non-optimization behaviour by economic agents, and again, accounting identities, not equilibrium concepts as determinants of model outcomes in response to the shocks. There's no supply in the form of a production function, which is probably just as well because, well, I won't go on to my normal criticism of the foundation of aggregate production function, so I'll just leave it at that. So that is, in a sense, a typical post-Keynesian approach. We've also got a return to Keynesian economics, Skidelsky's The Return of the Master, the reprinting of Minsky's John Maynard Keynes, Richard Posner's conversion to Keynesianism in an article in New Republic. He had never read Keynes. When he read it, he said, this is the explanation. So could this be a return to what Tobin called old Keynesianism, or what we would probably call post-Keynesianism? So just as the Great Depression was partly responsible for the eventual acceptance of the general theory, although Herr Schickel-Gruber was mainly responsible for the return to full employment, so maybe the credit crunch would lead, or is leading, to a nascence of Keynesian or post-Keynesian economics. But what's happened? Well, I think it's quite clear that the old neoclassical views have reasserted themselves. We've clearly got the Treasury view back in UK government circles. I had a quote from David Cameron, who actually said it was irresponsible for a government to increase government spending in a recession. And there was no qualification to that statement. And I think one of the nice things about Marx's paper is actually providing a theoretical counter-argument to that. And so we're going to get cuts that we haven't seen since the 1920s. Before moving on to Marx's paper, I just want a lovely quote from Brad DeLong talking about the views of some classical, new classical economists. And he goes through some statements they've made, and point by point he refutes them. And he says, the scary thing is not that Levine, Cochrane, Lucas, Prescott, Farmer, Zinglaise, and Boldrum are wrong. People are wrong all the time. The scary thing is the level at which they are wrong. These are all freshmen. No, okay, sophomore, mistakes. Yet the seven include two past, and a year ago I would have said three future Nobel laureates in economics. So that's what I mean about the debate has now really come down to the fundamentals of the way you believe the capitalist system works. So finally, I'm moving on to your paper, Mark, having spent 10 minutes on my own. what does he identify as the core of post-Keynesian economics? Well, the principle of effective demand in both the short and the long run, and I don't think any post-Keynesian or Keynesian would agree to that, would disagree with that, sorry. Sorry, just to get you awake there. Basically, the total irrelevance of Ricardian equivalence theory. I mean, how many of us here we are, economists, rational economists, have we been busy saving 3 years ago because of expected government raises of taxation, value-added tax going up?
Me.
There's always the exception that proves the rule. Again, the failure to understand the difference between investment savings equality as an identity and as an equilibrium. Read Brad DeLong's comment on Farmer, who makes exactly that mistake. Again, in the case of the long run, I think mentioned Ms. Meir of Tony Thirlwall's demonstration that the natural rate of unemployment is endogenous, and that in the long run it is affected by the rate of growth of demand. Therefore, in both the short run and the long run, demand is important. That's not to say that the supply side is totally irrelevant, and I hope nobody walks out of the room if I say that. What about excessive government borrowing and the budget deficit? Is it excessive? Do we worry that the manufacturing sector is a net borrower? Of course not, if it's put to productive purposes. Government a net borrower. Productive purposes, again, as Mark has mentioned, education, housing, etc. These are not burdens on future generations. These are benefits for future generation. What Malcolm Sawyer reminds us of is the deficit should be seen in the context of net total government assets and the rate of change of those assets. And calculations suggest that net government assets are substantial. And I think, indeed, there are signs that the government, as I may be wrong, I may be corrected here, as in Sweden, may actually be making a net profit on bailing out banks. If not, it should via the taxation system. I read today that the Royal Bank of Scotland, in which the taxpayer has an 84% stake, is paying out $1.2 billion in bonuses. The remuneration in Barclays Bank's relatively small investment section, and remember that they weren't actually bailed out, is $4 billion. $5.2 billion is going to be roughly the total cuts to higher education in the Comprehensive Spending Review. And that is the sums of money that are being paid out in bonuses to a relatively small number of bankers. Malcolm Sawyer has recently circulated a paper just showing, if we are to have the budget back in balance in 5 years, what the assumptions underlying the growth of the various components of demand are going to be. I think one of the figures that stuck in my mind is that investment is going to go up 44%. I think a post-Keynesian would think that was ridiculous. You're cutting demand, you're not going to get a revival of investment of 44%. Financial crowding out, well, if you look at long-term interest rates, they're still very low. There's no evidence of that. As Marx said, the government concern now seems to be with international financial markets and concern about long-term interest rates, but there does not seem to be a major problem there. Unemployment is not due to the real wage being too high. What's quite interesting is that in the standard neoclassical assumption, when you bring in the labour market, then the only way that you can really model unemployment is through wages being too high. There is one way that you can adjust this model, and I did this some time ago, where you introduce excess capacity. So that if demand falls and excess capacity rises, you can generate a falling real wage. Now, capacity utilization is a fact of life. We know that it exists. We know that in downturns, capital is laid off as well as labour. And facts of life can't be ignored by new classical economists. So how do they explain excess capacity? It's simple. It's optimal. In a recession, it pays to do more maintenance on your capital equipment. That's why your factories are idle. it must be optimal because of the underlying primary assumptions of new classical economics. This has actually got down to the textbook level. It's in Barrow's Macroeconomics. I think it's difficult to disagree anything Marx says about the international economy. It's somewhat odd in a supposedly scientific subject that views put forward some 60 years ago by Keynes about the asymmetrics of adjustment processes in the international economy are as relevant today and as pertinent today as they ever were. We do know that the balance of payments constraint, we do know that exchange rates do not link national economies. Whatever happened to the monetary view of the balance of payments? The major downturn in Germany is through the fall in demand for its exports more than anything else. Floating exchange rates between the euro and the USA and other countries have not done very much to alleviate that. And finally, turning to inflation, the great con trick of inflation targeting, that reminds me very much of the old-fashioned demand-pull inflation. What is absent from it is any consideration of the old-fashioned cost-push elements. And a lot of work that's been done on the inflation of the 1970s and 1980s suggests that it was initiated by a rapid rise in commodity prices. And the fall was also partly dependent upon commodity prices. I'm thinking here of the work by Wilfred Beckerman, and I think Frank Wilkinson has done a lot of work on this. Why has inflation targeting worked? Nothing to do with monetary policy. It may be something to do with aggressive competition in manufactured goods from China and the newly emerging economies, i.e. supply-side response. But I'm very pessimistic about, if there is a resurgence of inflation, about the future of incomes policies. It was tried, the most effective way it was tried in Australia in the 1980s. It was called the Accord, and it didn't work. It is very, very difficult to get labour unions, even when the Prime Minister is the ex-equivalent of was in fact one of the leading trade unions. It's very difficult to get that in an inflationary system to actually hold. So I'm very sceptical about incomes policies, but what do you put in its place? That, I think, is one of the great imponderables at the moment. I've gone on, I think, long enough. Paul mentioned non-ergodicity, and this has been certainly borne out by the subprime crisis, and it's been borne out by Keynes in his 1936 Quarterly Journal of Economics article. It always struck me as a retreat into elegant nihilism. If you believe in a non-ergodic world, apart from saying that there's a lot of uncertainty, what else can you say? I think I was wrong, because when you start looking at what people have been doing with non-Gaussian distributions, etc., I think there is a lot one can do, modelling uncertainty and modelling fat tails and things like that. I think most of us have read, was it Taleb's Black Swan, which was an informative, amusing attack on efficient markets hypothesis. But what's more important is if you look at the technical appendix of his book, you will there see alternative approaches to the modelling of risk. So I think there's a lot of work that can be done there, and I'm far more optimistic there about taking that forward than I was previously. Do we go into behavioural economics and identity economics? Do we replace rational expectations by behavioural economics? The problem with that is, do we stick with representative agent models? Behavioural economics might give us insights as to the way individuals behave, but does it give us a new approach to modelling macroeconomics? I think that is something that the future will tell us. But what is clear, and the great shortcoming, I think, of the new neoclassical economics, is the complete lack of knowledge of institutions. And I will finish by saying it was predicted, and it was predicted, and this has come out in a couple of places, by the chief economist of the IMF, whose name was Ranjan, I think, who wrote a very interesting paper, and I do, if you haven't read it, urge you to read it, where he virtually predicted the whole of the subprime crisis before it came, and the reasons for it. And he gave this as a presentation at the farewell dinner of Alan Greenspan, and he was attacked, and apparently Larry Summers said he was a Luddite because he didn't realise how these new derivatives and these new securitisations had made markets far more efficient. So on that point, I think I will end. Thank you.